Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy,
presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation.
We always started off by asking, tell us who you are and what you do, and Drew, why don't you start us off?
Hi, I'm Drew Diamond. I'm the retired police chief in Tulsa. I was on the department 22 years and retired actually a long time ago, end of 1991. Never left Tulsa, went on to lead a national police chiefs organization for the next 17 years and then retired from that. I keep retiring, then I retired. Then I became the executive director of the Jewish Federation and did that for our Zaro campus here in Tulsa, did that for 10 years and got us through COVID and retired again. Now I'm on new adventures, of all the hats I've worn over the years, our discussion today actually touches most of them.
All right, Representative Mintz, how about you?
Hi, everyone. I'm Representative Annie Mintz. I represent House District 45 in East Norman, and I am really excited to be on the podcast today. Looking forward to having this conversation about House Bill 4156, and just ready to go when you are.
Yeah, so this... this is, I feel like I've got to preface like everything we do this spring with it. We weren't doing anything for a couple months because there was nothing new. And, you know, so the podcast kind of went silent for literally 2 months because we had seen it all. And yet out of the blue, and I feel like this was truly out of the blue for Oklahoma. A few weeks ago, suddenly we hear House and Senate leadership are introducing bills regarding immigration. This is not a new issue for the United States. I could point everyone to the second chapter of my doctoral dissertation if you want an overview of how it has worked in this country.
Is that available for purchase through Amazon?
Just not through purchase, but you can certainly get it on ProQuest and you can read it there. And so help me get my the last 14 years of my royalties up from a nice little $35 from ProQuest. What, right? No, but all of this is to say is that immigration is not a new issue. It popped up in Oklahoma specifically in 2007, and it's usually... it usually comes up whenever state delegations decide that the federal government isn't doing enough. And, it's an election year. It's a presidential election year of all things. And so yet again, here we are talking about immigration. I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I am just going to say the very first paragraph of my dissertation says our nearest border with Mexico is over 500 miles away. And yet somehow... the state of Oklahoma decides that they have to present this new piece of legislation. Also note, I'm just going to say, note that it didn't get filed in the normal process. It didn't file it in December or, say they were going to file it in December. It wasn't filed in time for, deadlines in January, that this came up in the middle of the session, really kind of out of the blue. But in concert with the state of Texas deciding they were going to circumvent federal law, and decide that, matters that have traditionally been a federal issue were going to somehow be settled by the state. So with all of that said, maybe I did just write the introduction, Arnold. I might have just written the introduction that we were going to record later. Representative Mintz, I just want to point out that you are a member of the Latino Caucus in the House with Representative Alonzo as well as Senator Brooks. And can you give us an overview of how this was introduced in the House and then how the legislature has really reacted by it. I know that Senator Brooks convened a panel, you know, that this past week. So can you just kind of bring us into this, what's going on in the legislation?
And give us the highlights, please, of
yes, you
know, what essentially turns Oklahoma from a sundown town into a sundown state.
Yes.
Modern era.
Sure. And so, as Marianne mentioned, I am a member of the Oklahoma Legislative Latino Caucus. I'm one of the founding members. I'm the first Latina elected to the House of Representatives in state history. And with that comes a lot of responsibility. Not only, I mean, I represent the people of East Norman first and foremost, but I have a higher level of representation that I provide to for Latinos across the state. And it's important for me whenever we go to have forums and panels and we're talking about immigration, that we make it clear that while this does affect the Latino and Hispanic community in Oklahoma big time, it also it affects the entire immigrant community. So that's not just exclusively the Latino community, of course. And so, but the Latino caucus has been, as far as I have seen so far, the most vocal against this legislation. As Marianne said, we have had panels. So there was a town hall that was Monday, I believe, in Oklahoma City. We had over 600 people at that one. There was one in Tulsa, I believe Wednesday, that had over 1,000 people at it. And then there was a rally at the state capitol, and there were a couple hundred people there as well during the daytime on Wednesday. And that happened to be the same day that the bill passed through the Senate. And so people have been watching very, very closely from within the Latino community and just, you know, otherwise. And so a little bit of inside baseball I'm going to share with you guys. So
we love get wonky, so please do. Yeah.
I have some tea, as the kids say. So as Marianne said, it was filed. It was dropped in. The speaker has the privilege to be able to publish a bill direct to calendar without having to go through all of the hoops everybody else goes through, as far as the filing deadlines, the committee process, the public hearing process that you have to do in a committee. This bill did not receive the same level of scrutiny that other bills received. And typically this time, like around March, like early mid-March, that's whenever we kind of start to see when the House bills and the Senate bills switch chambers, we kind of start to see what I like to call the Speaker and the Pro Tem doing their Sharks and Jets routine. and there's always something that they're using for leverage, and it gets mixed up in the budget negotiations process. And I believe that this immigration bill was it. So evidently, from what I've heard, the pro tem in the Senate didn't really have much of an appetite for this bill. It was the speaker, and we have to also kind of mention that the person who apparently wrote this language was the AG, who is not a legislator and does not legislate and doesn't work here. But he really wanted it. I'm sure we all know why. So this was the speaker, this was the AG. They really wanted to do this. And whenever Speaker McCall wants something, I mean, the House Majority Caucus jumps to it. And so it was rushed. It was, you know, the Latino caucus, we kind of knew it was coming because we were watching what was going on in Texas, and we were having conversations with just some of our allies in the majority party. And so we figured that this was coming. So we were kind of putting together some amendments. We were having conversations, reaching out to folks we have relationships with, and kind of working on the back end, just waiting for all of this to hit the public, so that we would be ready to really like explain what's going on to our community. And so, I mean, now here we are, we've got it, through, it's gotten through both chambers. Again, didn't have to go through the committee process. So that's how it's gotten, it happened so fast. I mean, it seems like people have whiplash from when the speaker published that press release saying we're interested in doing this thing that Texas did, to where we are today. It seems like it was just like 5 minutes. And so people went from, you know, they were at peace one day and now turmoil. And so we've really been doing our best at communicating with them, like what it is that they can do. And the fact that this has not been signed into law yet. There is an emergency on the bill. So whenever the governor signs it, it becomes effective. Mm-hmm. So at this point he hasn't signed it. Last week he was on the record saying he wasn't sure if he was going to sign it. We had heard a rumor he was going to sign it the other day, but he didn't. And so we've mobilized people to contact the governor and ask him and urge him to veto it. And so far as I know, there have been over 7,000 emails in a 24-hour period sent to him and thousands of phone calls. I mean, they shut down his phone system yesterday afternoon, I think, because I mean, this is just like an outcry. Just please veto this. It's not a good idea. So that's where we're at right now.
Well, and of course, we know, too, that as an aside, that given the state of relations between the governor and the legislature at this point, he's been sort of willy-nilly vetoing things, you know, to tweak them. So if he knows they really want this, he might just do it, even though I suspect in his heart of hearts, he probably thinks it's a good idea.
Well, and I think that you'd be right about that. But if you notice the things that he's vetoing, they're Senate bills. It's yes. And so and that is kind of by design. And I know I think it was maybe day before yesterday that Pro Tem Treat did an interview where he talked about kind of the beef going on between the Senate and there's always just this, it's the Sharks and Jets thing. They're all kind of just in their respective little corners and they're going at each other and people out here are suffering. I mean, we delayed this process so badly that yesterday on deadline day, we were rushing through bills and it felt dirty. It felt like these are people's lives we're affecting. This is policy that we're voting on and you're rushing through it because we're trying to get out of here by a certain time because it's a deadline day. Yesterday, or the day before yesterday, it was OSU day at the Capitol. Beautiful. Like it was really awesome. And now they're my favorite Big 12 team. So I was excited to be able to wear orange. But
spoken
I mean,
spoken like a true politician.
Yeah. Right. They're my favorite Big 12 team now. And so we spent like an hour on a floor presentation for that. And instead of doing the work of the people, and then that caused the rush yesterday to be able to try and make up for that time, but we were rushing through all these bills and it's just this chaotic sort of disorganization because of the infighting. And that's where the people truly suffer from the egos up there.
So to kind of recap, mm-hmm. what, you know, just from what I'm hearing is like, so we have people with intentions for higher office exploiting an already vulnerable community, all for political gain, based on absolutely zero like real facts, right? What we used to call the reality-based community.
Right. No, that's absolutely right. Yeah.
But in the meantime, you know, in the meantime, it's absolutely clogging up the works.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping anything else from happening. And it's literally happening in the dark of night. Like this is always the story, right? These big bills, these big things, they never happen through the full process of the legislature. They're snuck in leadership. And I'm saying all this for the record. Representative Mintz is not saying this. But they always happen through the shortcuts that leadership has at their disposal, not through the committee process, not through the true full vetting of the issues, right? Did I miss anything, y'all?
No, I think that's a pretty good summation. I mean, yeah, it's all political. And if we want to kind of get into the problematic parts of the bill, which I would love to hear from Mr. Diamond about for sure, because the law enforcement perspective was something that we brought up numerous times. In fact, the amendment that I offered to the bill, it was meant to protect people who are U.S. citizens who are wrongly detained or arrested. It was just a cause of action. And I thought that was like common sense, right? Because yeah, the bill is written so vaguely, and certainly the opportunity presents itself for people who are citizens to be arrested because they're profiled and thrown in jail and, you know, having their rights violated that way.
And that is empirically what happens.
Absolutely.
This is what we know 100% true happens. There is no distinguishing between, it's just if they look like an immigrant, they get wrapped up in it.
And Drew, you know, has been, you've seen it from the front lines. And this has been on your radar because you implemented a policy when you were the chief of police at Tulsa that was to ensure that this very sort of thing couldn't, this show me your papers sort of approach, mm-hmm, you know, would be constrained. So what are the dangers?
Tell us about that.
Tell us about that. And also, you know the dangers firsthand of what could happen if somebody says, if a law officer says, that person doesn't look like me.
Yeah, let me, you know, for our listeners, let me set it up. And Arnold knows this. He's been to my house. I still live in the house I built in East Tulsa, 31st and Garnett, in 1970, a year after I came on the Tulsa Police Department. They were still pastures cows out here. Arnold knows East Tulsa. He used to live in East Tulsa. And this issue is, you know, as we just said, is not a new issue. When we had, I helped organize the forum here. I'm part of, for 30 some years, I've been part of the Hispanic Coalition, among other things. And at St. Thomas More, you know, around the corner from my house, we did have 1,000 really frightened people. These are my neighbors, besides me being, you know, all my years in the department being their police chief. And in 1990, I mean, 35 years ago, I had the opportunity, it was the first in the nation, I put together a committee as I once want to do in my community policing stuff, members of all the immigrant communities in the city. And I put them in my conference room, and we wrote this policy in about 3 days. And the policy still exists today. It's evolved over the years, but here's the core language that still exists today. The Tulsa Police Department does not and will not engage in the practice of stopping, detaining, questioning, or arresting any person based solely on the suspicion that individual may be in the United States illegally. That's been our policy, and it is currently this. And when the police department adopts a policy, the city adopts it. It is the policy of the city of Tulsa. And, you know, it's not perfect, but it helped us deal from a policing standpoint, at least for our city, to train all the officers for the last 35 years that this is what we do. we have officers, and I know the stories because I'm involved with the community, you know, still every day, that officers try to get around this by officers will make pretext stops. They'll, you know, I wrote a book years ago on racially biased policing. And so the sense of, but it minimizes it. What this legislation does, this is, by the way, in my over 50 years of dealing with this stuff here, this is the worst piece of legislation I've seen. It really is. It's not only unconstitutional, you know, getting about the attorney general and them, you know, parsing the language in this doesn't make it constitutional, you know. You know, I have a thought about that towards the end, but the thing that this does, it unleashes the worst aspects of racially biased policing, of, you know, of driving while Black and driving while brown have been a historically real problem in the entire in policing nationally, but certainly in our state. And, you know, and we've had our issues here in Tulsa, and certainly we've had them, you know, in the other parts of the state. This kind of legislation says to those police officers that want to behave that way, that are racially biased, go ahead and do this. You know, what they won't do is set up a roadblock at 91st and Yale in South Tulsa and check, ask people if they're citizens, you know. They'll do it here at 31st and Garnett on in the east side. I'll say this, and I'll say it on the record. If I was still police chief and this thing becomes law, the first thing I would do is set up checkpoints in South Tulsa and ask every white person coming through. Tell me, here's the reality. With this, the way this is written, it says, you know, it leaves it up to law enforcement because it makes it a crime. It makes it a statutory crime to determine, you know, who's a citizen, right? And, you know, who's here legally. And don't show me a driver's license because, back Arnold, when I was years working undercover, I used to buy Oklahoma driver's licenses in bars, you know, fake driver's license. Show me your passport or an original birth certificate. Now show me your papers. Now, we don't mind asking brown and Black people to show me their papers, but we don't want to ask white folk to show me your papers. And you want to put a stop to this? Arrest them. And, you know, you're right about the way this is written. You get arrested first, then you have to prove, you have to come back to court, then you get arrest record, you get booked, then you get to come back and say, okay, here's my passport, I'm really a citizen. How insane is that?
It tosses the presumption of innocence on its head.
Out the window.
And what's the probable cause too?
Right? Well, here's the other problem with it. And I can't believe the attorney general, you know, what's really irritating me about how this came about is, first of all, you know, the 14th Amendment, the Constitution says every person is entitled to due process and protection. We're in the business of protecting, and I wrote it in my editorial, right, on protecting every person's human rights, their civil rights, and their dignity, that it's constitutionally protected. And, you know, the idea that we're going to kind of get over that because we make up an invasion. By the way, in that, one of my other many editorial comments, I've been for the last almost 60 years policing in this state, and we have not been invaded. Undocumented persons from any place are not an imminent danger to the end of our state, the way it's written in this thing. When you write language like that and you create a statutory violation, you know, that has serious consequences, and then you unleash the police because they say, you know, we're fighting invaders, you're setting everybody up for serious human rights and civil rights violations, The majority, don't feel it, until it backlashes on them. So the way this legislation is written, and being 500 miles from, by the way, 500 miles from the border, I spent years after I retired from police department consulting for the INS and the U.S. Border Patrol. I spent a lot of time on the southern border and in Mexico, so I'm not speaking through my hat here. And the federal crime, which is a federal responsibility by the Constitution of the United States, is illegal entry at the border. It's a misdemeanor status crime. So when does an Oklahoma police officer, a law enforcement officer, he has to see that happen to make that arrest. What this does is say, oh, you don't have to see it.
You just have to presume it.
And that is a constitutional violation. In the first couple of lines in our book and research, 20 some years ago on racially biased policing, says that you cannot legally and constitutionally use race as probable cause or reasonable belief. You can't. And they know that. The attorney general knows it. The guys, Treat, McCall know that. They don't care. What they want this to do, they're going to create a case law. This is going to happen. They want it to go to this current Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
They want this to go up to that court. And under their draconian, stuff, they believe that this Supreme Court will say, all right, the states have a right. We're going to change the Constitution. States have a right to enforce immigration laws. Well, the better immigration law we should enforce is at the Red River, and build a wall and maybe keep Texans out, or at least charge them a fee to come into Oklahoma. So this whole thing, my real deep concern, though, is we do know that there will be law enforcement in this state that will overstep, that they'll see two Hispanic kids driving their car down the street and they'll stop them. And they'll stop them for a pretext, for tag light or making a turn or something. And the first question is going to be, show me your papers. And, when they can't or shouldn't, by the way, you're not obligated to prove you're a citizen. There's nothing in this, they can't. There's nothing in this law. When you get stopped and somebody says, are you a U.S. citizen? What I tell people is the next word out of your mouth is lawyer. Yeah, you're obligated to show your driver's license. If you're driving, your insurance and your registration. Other than that, you are not obligated to. I mean, we've had officers in the past ask our Hispanic community people. They know they couldn't ask them if they're a U.S. citizen, so they ask them what their Social Security number is. And by the way, that's the dumbest thing to do, because we have a lot of undocumented people working in this country that have Social Security numbers. I mean, but that's how stupid some of this stuff is.
So Annie, do we have to wait for somebody to be pulled over like this, to be profiled and pulled over, to challenge it on constitutional grounds?
I want to say yes. I would think so. But then going back to what Mr. Diamond just said, I mean, the AG, the Speaker of the Pro Tem, they all know what this is about, and they all know what they were doing. I mean, they just didn't care, because, just to touch back on what Marianne said earlier, I mean, this is an election year, and we have a former president who's running for president again, literally calling members of Congress, one of whom serves in the Oklahoma delegation and was working diligently on trying to get some sort of deal. Because let's be very clear, there is a problem. We have challenges at the southern border, and we have Senator Lankford working on that. And we have this you know, former president who is discouraging him and from getting a deal, from fixing the problem, because they want it for political talking points. And I mean, that's what this entire thing is about. And the proof there is that myself and my colleagues in the Latino caucus tried to offer amendments to make it a little bit better. We've also, you know, offered invitations to come talk to us. We've said it at every point, you know, during debate, during question, in press releases and press conferences. Hey, come talk to us. Like, this is not a good idea, but I bet we can find one out there somewhere if we just talk about it. And another proof of this being just a political stunt is that minutes before the bill was brought up on the House floor, the AG sent out a press release that was very strongly worded, calling people names. And that right there, I mean, he assumed, which we all know what happens when you assume. He assumed some things, assumed what we would be saying down there. And we said the exact opposite when we flat out started out our questioning and debating, saying, there have been failures on the federal level, and we have some solutions that we can do. This is largely a federal issue, yes, but there are things we can do as a state, and we have ideas. That threw him for a loop. He didn't think we were going to say things like that. And that right there is also indicative of the fact that he doesn't understand how legislating works. Like, you have these conversations so that you know what the other side is thinking, so that you know what the other side, how they feel, what their position is. And you go from there. And again, he's a smart man. And so, I mean, all signs point to politics on this.
Yeah. Let me just, again, historical context. There are problems at the border. There were problems when I was doing that work with them in the 90s, and again in a few years ago. But the solution's always been there. I was part of a group in the mid 90s with a friend of mine who was an INS Immigration National Relations Services commissioner. We helped, and I helped them formulate a plan, you know, for guest workers and for visa checks and all that stuff, you know, and the Border Patrol loved it. And because what the Border Patrol said then, I'm not sure it's sometimes politically where they are at the moment, but what they said then was, let us deal with the workers and the people who want to come to work separately, away from the criminal element. And I will tell you, as one of those guys who works on national, international terrorism also, that's the right thing to do. And that's where the energy has to be.
But how do you make that distinction, right? Like, how do you ingrain that into the policing mentality that, you know, how does that happen?
Well, this is, Here, what you have to do is you have, by the way, this is about race. This is racist stuff. I would tell you right now. We have problems on the northern border, and you don't hear us wanting to build a wall with Canada. I mean this, and so let's get that. So we have to deal with the sense of the racial elements of this. And the way you do it is pretty easy. You know, before we turned this into this racially charged piece of work, the U.S. Border Patrol it used to work cross-border with the federales. I mean, the major border cities in Texas and in New Mexico and California. I mean, if you ever been, you know, worked on those more, been there, lived there, I mean, those are commercial centers, and so the intelligence information, the criminal intelligence, the work, it was pretty straightforward to figure out who the bad guys were and who's a migrant worker or who's an asylum seeker. This is not brain surgery. This is straightforward and easy to do. We chose, and certainly in the last couple of years, and certainly this year, we've chosen not to do this. On any given day, there are hundreds of thousands of people from all over the world in this country who are overstaying their visas.
And I'm just going to say that is the biggest driver behind any sort of undocumented immigration.
Yeah, and so they've already been through the system. They've been cleared and they're overstaying their visas. I don't hear any charge to round up all them. By the way, a large segment of those are Europeans. We're not doing anything to round up Europeans who are in this country working over education overstaying their visas. They're not going to get stopped and asked, for your papers because they're not brown or black.
Right. And
this is not a problem without a solution. The problem is, as Representative said, is that we've turned it into this political fear mongering, and sadly, fear and racial fear works for us.
I just want to bring up too, like this rhetoric that comes from specifically Donald Trump and his camp about closing the border, right? Like, I mean, the catastrophe at closing the southern border of the United States, the economic catastrophe, billions of dollars of commerce happen every day, all along the U.S. border with Mexico. And we know that a Trump administration is not beyond, for instance, sanctions, not even sanctions, but tariffs and whatnot, crippling measures on the U.S. economy. But I just want to say that. But at the same time, like reducing this to merely an economic issue in terms of commerce and labor is problematic because it also has other effects, right? So, Drew, can you talk to what happens in a community when they are over-policed like this? I mean, so you know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. Like they don't call the police when they need them.
Yeah, we've always been, and that's why I did that, 35, 40 years ago.
Yeah, this is not a new issue. Yes,
not a new issue. I recognized it, and we did a little better in Tulsa than most major cities. We're like the 42nd, 46th largest city in the country. I mean, we're in the top 50 cities, and we do much better. And I'm talking about Tulsa now. In terms of this kind of pocket, and even with that, we had issues, but we were able to deal with them without driving fear. And all that is about who leads and who how you lead and train your officers and what the mission of the agency is. But the fear now, what I saw, and I think you guys, what I saw Tuesday night at St. Thomas More Church, my 1,000 neighbors in there, they were quiet and frightened and whether they're citizens or documented or undocumented, we all have family. My neighbors and on each side of me, I mean, I know, and so no matter what anybody says, we're trying to get the police department to come out and calm their fears, and I'm not sure they will. And quite frankly, I think the mayor has been, he says, well, we're not going to change our policy, but he kind of says, well, but I kind of understand why they're doing this. And we've not, as the old retired police chief, I can say we've not heard from the current police chief. And what should be said from the mayor and the police chief is that first policy line for their policy, they should reiterate that so their officers hear it and the community hears it, says, we're not going to do this. By the way, this legislation, there's some positive holes in this because they rushed it. I'm almost reluctant to tell them where the holes are, but the hole is, there's no sanction for police departments or anybody. You don't have to ask the question. no police officer in this state. Policing is a discretionary practice. You don't have to do this. You do. There's nothing in the law that says when you make a traffic stop, you have to ask any questions about citizenship or where you were born or where you came from. You don't have to do it. And every sheriff and police chief in this country should sit their office in this state should sit their officers down and tell them that you don't have to do it. There'll be officers who are going to do it anyway because we have bias officers. I still do police training, believe it or not, in the state and on race on implicit biasness and stuff. So we still have officers that are going to do that, but we won't have whole agencies and whole departments. So one of the things that we're trying to get out is to tell police leadership, there's no mandate here. You do not have to do this. And you want to keep your community calm in Norman or in Oklahoma or anywhere else, then go out and tell them we are not going to bother you with this.
Well, this actually would make policing tougher, right? Because all of a sudden you've got a whole community, in effect, saying, we don't trust these guys. They may want to round us up and ship us out. They're not going to be very helpful if you're trying to investigate some serious matter.
Yeah. Right. And so the former Chief City in OKC had... made that point, and he used an example of domestic violence to drive it across. Like, what if there is an undocumented family experiencing domestic violence and this prevents them from calling for help? I mean, we're backing people into a serious corner, and it just further drives a wedge between law enforcement and this community.
There's even a more as serious and that is serious. This is life threatening for that reason. And another reason in this legislation, they talk about fentanyl and all the stuff coming across. Arnold remembers I ran the organized crime vice narcotics intelligence division as I was coming up through the ranks and I worked those things. And I've designed the intelligence blueprinting nationally for policing in this country over the years. And without the community, without having the trust of any community parts, regardless of race or religion or economic stature, you have no intelligence information. You can't stop any of these guys from dealing drugs. It will get worse, not better. So in that level, this is just stupid from a policing standpoint. This is a stupid piece of legislation. It puts everybody at risk so they can thump their chest and I guess get a pat on the head from Donald Trump. I'll be quite. I mean,
what I will say then is it becomes exactly a self-fulfilling. Yeah, I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt. But I mean, it also becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy then, right? Yes. Fewer right. reports to the fewer reports, the police right. crime goes up.
Yeah.
Yes. And so we brought that up. Because obviously this is racist. I mean, that's the obvious thing yes. about this legislation.
Unequivocally, yes.
and but the more not obvious problems with it for some of my colleagues are the economic and workforce implications, the law enforcement implications and the legal ramifications. And so those were the points that we tried to convey because we're going to spin our tires up there talking about race issues, and why are we going to state the obvious over and over again? We know what this is about, but here are the consequences and we will present them over and over and over again. People who are undocumented, who do not have social security numbers but want to pay taxes, go to the IRS and they get what's called an I-10 number. That has been happening for a long time. It's lawful. The IRS does it. That's the federal level. So last year, undocumented people with I-10 numbers in Oklahoma paid $26 million in income taxes. That's not including sales taxes and any other taxes. That's just income taxes paying into a system that they're not going to be able to reap the benefits from. So one of the questions I asked was, do you have a plan to make up that budget hole? Do you have a plan to fill that hole if all those people leave? Do you have $26 million that you can fork over to OTC right now to make that up? And of course not, because we didn't think it through. We brought up the issues with law enforcement and about how this is going to drive up crime. This is going to make things worse, not better, for law enforcement. And we're also, by the way, adding more onto our law enforcement's plate without giving them resources or tools. And we're expecting them to do this. And then we did get feedback. We did get some concerns from Tulsa area law enforcement and Oklahoma City area law enforcement. They were vocal about providing us what their concerns were. And then, of course, the legal ramifications. This is what's happening with this same type of legislation in Texas and in other states that we can point to. And so we tried our best, and we're still out here making those points, especially to the governor. Like, it's not worth it. The political aspect, the racial aspect, making yourselves feel better, like he said, beating your chest and getting a pat on the head, it's not worth it. It's not worth the money. It's not worth the work for the skilled labor that's going to leave, you know, putting more of a burden on law enforcement. It's not worth it.
Yeah. And that's right on. And my experience in this, though, tells me something about, and I understand, because we've all been in this a long time, about dealing with the racial aspects of this, and how difficult that is. A few years ago, I request of a pretty progressive police chief in a county, a really rich county in Northern Virginia. They faced this. They had a county commission that decided they wanted the police to round up all undocumented immigrants, and because they were tired of seeing them on the corners waiting to go to work. And so they passed some pretty nasty, draconian county regulations. And we got a study with the university there, and my group, we did a study and showed that county, if they did this, both documented and undocumented Hispanic workers would leave the county, and they'd lose $1 billion in the first year that this happened. And we showed it to them, and how much money was actually coming in because of those workers. And they said, we don't care. We want them off our streets. And the same language that's in this bill, quite frankly, was being used then. And we came back 2 years later to show them that they'd lost a little over $1 billion, and maybe they ought to rethink what they're doing. And they said, yeah, but we got rid of them. They didn't care. That's how deep this was. The police chief, who was a friend of mine, he didn't enforce it. And they drove him out of office because he did what he was a man of conscience. And he said, I'm not going to tell my officers to do this. It's illegal. It's unconstitutional. But the community, particularly of workers, documented, undocumented, fled that county regardless, because the fear that the leadership was driving was that effective. That's what I'm afraid of here.
I can see it happening here. And that, as Annie, as you were talking a minute ago, it made me wonder if this isn't another sort of reflection of urban-rural divide, in a state where the legislature is still sort of rural-dominated because of gerrymandering.
And I want to jump on that, piggyback on that, Arnold, because when you look at Senator Treat's hesitance versus, Representative McCall's, like, chomping at the bit, and also A.G. Gittner's, Drummond's, like, yes, I think that right there, demonstrates some sort of rural versus urban divide, right? Like, just who was raring to go on this,
Yeah, but who's going to take care of a lot of those jobs in rural Oklahoma that are currently being filled by folks who have come in, you know, desperately in search
because
of
there's so many.
History of this tells us nobody. And Texas, in all their insanity there, and we should learn something on the other side from Texas. Remember a few years ago when, as they ramped up all this stuff, when we were doing 1804 here and they were trying to outdo us, they couldn't find migrant workers to pick onions and work their fields, you know, out in that hot sun in East Texas. And they went out to the local community to, and instead of paying their $4 and their subhuman wages, they were offering up to $19, $20 an hour to people from their little towns around there, to the white folk. Nobody would do it. They plowed those fields on under, and we paid a higher price for onions across the country. But the effect was didn't make the Texas legislators say, oh man, maybe we got this wrong. They just doubled down.
You know what? Like I have a few thoughts about this. One, if you look at this from a labor lens, a lens of labor, right? It's not unlike what we're seeing happen to teachers. Right. People are going to leave the industry but they're just going to continue to be vilified. Teachers are going to be like, you know what? I don't need this. And you know what? They don't. And they're going to leave and we're going to suffer for it economically. Right. Same thing's going to happen to our immigrant communities, largely our Latino communities, because they're good. I don't want them to leave, but you know what? No one needs to put up with this. But at the same time, I just want to point out that we had no immigration laws in this country. We had zero immigration laws in this country until the 1880s with the, you know, Chinese Exclusion Act. And that was purely born out of xenophobia, racism, in the sense that Chinese were taking the jobs of white people in the United States, right? And then that's when they decided to do anything at all about restricting immigration to and from the United States from other parts of the country. And specifically the southern border with the United States was just like an open door for decades in the United States. And it was largely because of that migrant labor that was coming in, that, you know, in the agricultural regions in that part of the United States. People were just coming and going. It was nothing anyone at all worried about after Texas was became a state from in the US. Like, they just came and went. People just came and went. It was not an issue. The migrant workers were just a part of the world, right? Like, no one worried about it. And so it's just like this idea that we've always had these permanent like borders anywhere. First of all, I'm just going to go back to the billions of dollars of commerce that happens all along the US border. But also, I just want to think of like people in McCurtain County, people in Northeast Oklahoma, people in the Panhandle and in Southwest Oklahoma. There's nothing permanent about any border in the state of Oklahoma, right? You see those people living in the communities along the borders of Oklahoma, and they go back and forth between Texas, Kansas, New Mexico, Arkansas, all day, every day. Right. I mean, it's just like it happens, and we act like these are something permanent and like there's some concrete wall and someone's like opening the door for you and closing it behind you. It's just not what happens, and it can't happen and it won't happen. And it's purely artificial. So anyways, it just the history of it is phenomenal because it is always connected. It is always connected in this country to some racist impulse. And it never benefits anybody, and it always swings back in this to the side of, well, we have lost workers, and so they figured it out, so they come up with these guest worker programs, right? That was the back and forth throughout the 20th century. Was we got to shut it down, we introduced quotas and you know, in the 1924, and then the 1950s, like, oh, we need some workers back, and so they changed it. But anyways, I we cannot fail to connect this to the white crystal fascism, because that's behind all of it.
And you know, that's so correct. And I think Arnold and you and I discussed this in the past, when I I rarely, I try not to invoke the Holocaust, you know, for lots of reasons in my public stuff or when I write. But I did this time in my last Sunday's op-ed, because there comes a point, though, when there's lessons from history and lessons that, as you just laid out, the lessons of the Holocaust are clear around this matter. There's language in the Nuremberg laws that began to restrict Jews and Romas, gypsies, and others. It's in this bill. I mean, the language that, you know, it doesn't, about show me your papers. What Hitler said was only those people we deem as bona fide citizens of the Third Reich will be protected by law. Everybody else is an other. And subject to, they get no protection, no legal protections, no job protections, nothing. That's what this type of legislation actually says. It says that unless you're, by the way, which under our Constitution is absolutely wrong. You know, and get back to the Attorney General. I mean, it's really disgusting because he knows this. They know this, but. What happens is when those that would invoke these kind of fascist Nazi things and use that kind of language, and the rest of everybody just kind of stands by and says, well, it doesn't affect me, they become bystanders. And those of us, you know, who are activists around this, who are up, trying to be upstanders about it, we end up in what we just did for this last hour. We end up saying, you know, talking to our choir, which always needs, they always need to be reinforced, trying to influence those who are bystanders, but we're not going to have much effect on the perpetrators. These guys, and, you know, and so trying to build something around them and trying to get people, particularly people who are, as you mentioned, in rural Oklahoma and others, to understand, you know, when they get done with us, they're coming for you. You don't get this. They're coming for you. And that's never changed in human history.
Representative Mintz, I know you have a hard stop at 11, so is there anything else that we can add to this that you want to say?
I mean, I don't know that there is anything else to say. I mean, I think we've mobilized folks. This is something that has brought folks off the sidelines. And it should give us all pause. And we should be reflecting on, I mean, I know it's happening fast and it's hard to kind of get past the fear of it all. But those like yourselves who are allies and who have a firm grasp on what this is and what the immigration, system looks like in this country and the scope of it all, to just take time to reflect on this turning point in our country. And again, the historical, like what history has taught us about these things, and what it says about ourselves and how we view the American dream here. I think it's different for immigrants. I think, can't remember if it was LA Times, New York Times that did a piece about the people who believe in the American dream still, and the most are immigrants, the Latino community, immigrants specifically, and I think it's just there's a lot to think about, because again, there are so many bad things about this bill. It's just a really bad bill. And I do want to say to any of my colleagues listening, any would-be elected officials, currently elected officials looking at the next rung up, I get it. But no elected office is worth your soul. None. So value doing the right thing over doing what people want you to do or what you think might get you more votes. And that's it. I think that's all.
I think that's a good way to stop. I don't know if we can get any better than that.
Just want to thank you both for spending some time with us today to talk more about this issue. Just can't understate how important it is, how that it will have impact and in all the wrong ways, that it solves no problem, but it only causes more. So Representative Mitz, thank you for your work on this. And I hope on our part, we can help mobilize and maybe just maybe it'll get vetoed. Thank you, guys.
You all.
Yep. We will talk again.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.